Hello and welcome to New Netherland Praatjes, a series of chats on the Dutch colony of New Netherland, brought to you by the New Netherland Institute and the New Netherland Research Center in Albany, New York. Praatjes is Dutch for chat, and these are informal conversations with historians, archaeologists, and other experts on the world of the 17th century Dutch. Hello, welcome to another edition of New Netherland Praatjes. My name is Russell Shorto. I'm senior scholar at the New Netherland Institute. Our guest today is Dr. Susanna Romney. She is assistant professor at the University of Arkansas at Little Rock and the author most recently of the award-winning book, New Netherland Connections, Intimate Networks and Atlantic Ties in 17th Century America. Susanna, welcome.
Thank you.
Let's start autobiographically. Tell us a bit about yourself, your background. Were you fascinated by history as a little girl? You know, that's that kind of thing.
I got into history basically because I enjoyed it so much in college, and I had such wonderful teachers in college. I went to the University of California, Santa Cruz. And I had just wonderful teachers of early American history, Lynn Westerkamp doing early North America and David Sweet doing colonial Latin America. So it wasn't necessarily something I was really fascinated by as a kid, but rather something that I just found really interesting in college. And then I went to graduate school at Cornell University. I already thought I might be interested in working on the Dutch because there had been relatively little written on the Dutch colonies in North America, at least as compared to New England, where there's so much that's been written on the Puritans. So I went in part to Cornell in upstate New York because I thought that would be a good place to develop the skills I needed to work on the Dutch. And there I studied with Professor Mary Beth Norton, who was just a wonderful person and a wonderful scholar who was always encouraging me. And at the time, too, Cornell also offered Dutch classes, which, of course, was really essential. So from there, I was able to get a fellowship from the federal government, a foreign language and area studies fellowship, to go and spend a year as a graduate student at Leiden University and finish up my Dutch language studies and also do research in the notarial archives in Amsterdam while I was there.
Because most people have virtually no association with the Dutch period of American colonial history. So how did, you know, where did you cross paths with it, and what piqued your interest?
Yeah, you know what I found really fascinating about the Dutch was the diversity of the colony, that there were slaves there. There was a Native American trade there, but there were also family migrants there from Europe. So that's a really pretty unusual combination, or at least it seemed to me at the time to be a pretty unusual combination to have all those things going on in one area. At one time. And being in upstate New York, even though I was obviously further west in Ithaca from the heart of the Hudson Valley, you really get a sense that this is an amazing geographical area, that it's got incredible resources in terms of the environment, and that clearly it was going to be an important place that people were going to fight over. So I think it was really the diversity that drew me to the colony.
So that was relatively unusual compared to other colonies, and that it was understudied. That combination intrigued you.
Right. Yeah, exactly. I mean, it was clear from the beginning that there were a lot of sources out there that nobody had looked at. They were just locked up in the Dutch language. Mm-hmm. And the people of the New Netherland Institute, Charlie Gehring and Jannie Venema, were already busy translating them, but there's more than they could possibly get to.
There's lots and lots. They kept very good records in the Dutch.
they did. And fortunately, you know, a lot more of them have survived than is the case for some colonies. So,
and what is it like pursuing that that topic at the University of Arkansas at Little Rock? Is that a little bit tricky, or is it actually a good base for it?
Well, yeah, I mean, it's a good base for it in that it's, you know, it's a strong university, and I've got strong colleagues and good students here. So I'm always able to offer new classes, and that keeps me thinking and, you know, keeps me sort of alive with new ideas and things like that.
And what do you teach? What do you offer classes in?
Oh, I teach a whole lot of different early American history classes. So I teach colonial American history. I have a class that I did last spring on frontiers in American history. This coming semester, I'm teaching one on witchcraft and gender in the early modern Atlantic world. And last fall, I did a new one, which was tons of fun, on pirates, explorers, and seafarers. And that one actually let me draw in a lot more Dutch language originals that have been translated and things like that into a real maritime history class. So it was a whole lot of fun.
Wonderful. I'm reading right now the galley of Stacy Schiff's new book about the Salem witch trials, which is just so full of... The main thing about it is the richness of detail in sort of constructing that world and that story. As you get into these, you know, you pick an area, and especially in the case of the Dutch, there's so many records that you are actually able to flesh out something that had previously just been available kind of in skeleton form.
Yeah, well, and that's something I think that's very particular to colonial history, too, is that because the number of people who appear in the records is relatively small compared to something like the 20th century, you can really become almost a voyeur. You know, you can reconstruct the details of people's lives, and you get to know them by name and have a sense of how many cows they had and what neighbors they got along with and what neighbors they didn't. So that's one of the things I think that makes colonial history a whole lot of fun.
Yeah, and are your students... what's their reaction? Are they interested? Are they what's their perspective? Are you impressed by their ignorance? Or
well, of course, I mean, I think with anybody, the general knowledge in American society of early American history is not always that high. It doesn't appear in a whole lot of movies, and I think that's the way that people consume a lot of history today. But yeah, no, students are really interested to realize that even back in the 1600s, people were living in a really diverse America, that they were trying to figure out, not always very fairly, but they were trying to figure out how to live together with many different racial and ethnic groups. Students are always fascinated by the fact that, you know, even back in the 1600s, people did live in a global world. People like to use that phrase today and say we live in a global village, but, you know, it was true from a long time ago, and people were really working hard at the time to try and figure out the implications of that kind of worldwide connection in their daily lives. So yeah, I think students tend to be pretty open to realizing that there was this fascinating world way back when. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay, let's talk a little bit about your book. The title is New Netherland Connections, but the key phrase, I think, is in the subtitle, Intimate Networks. And it's a really interesting paradigm that you have for kind of rethinking in particular, the Dutch Empire and the Dutch in the 17th century. Unpack it a little bit. What are these intimate networks?
Well, intimate networks is just a phrase that I came up with to try and express the kinds of social connections that people relied on to navigate their world as they were entering this really diverse society, as they were, participating in transatlantic and international travel for the first time. That was a big change. Most people's lives in Europe and in the 1500s had been organized around their village, really. They might have called it a town or a city, but from today's perspective, these were really small places where everybody knew people face to face. And then all of a sudden, you know, people are living in a much more mobile, much more changeable world. And it really struck me from the beginning that you would think that kind of travel and that kind of change would cut them off from the people that they knew best, from the people that they knew intimately in the household and the family. But instead, what I found is that people really relied on these same face-to-face, deeply personal relationships, even as they were traveling around the world and even as they were meeting people from profoundly different societies that they'd never really experienced before, they made new connections with people wherever they went. So they formed new intimate relationships, familial relationships, friendships. But they also held on to the ties that they had before. And that's really how they organized their lives. So it seemed to me that all of these family connections and personal connections and friendships really were overlapping to form networks that were what people relied on to survive. In this really challenging environment in the 1600s.
And this is something that's different in the 17th century? It emerges in a different way from previous eras?
Well, I suspect so, yeah. I think that the whole early modern period from the time of Columbus's discovery up through the American Revolutionary period, I think that whole period of time is a period of change. And it obviously reached some people faster than others. People along the coast in Europe and Africa and America experienced some of these changes first. But it's really an unfolding process throughout all these three continents during this time period. So, you know, it happens at different times in different places. And for the Netherlands, it's really beginning in the 1590s through the 1690s, that 100-year period where they're experiencing it firsthand the most. In that sense, I think that these level of changes are new and different for these people. Yeah.
I think, as you kind of suggested earlier, when you are passively thinking about that era, you tend to think of, okay, people left Europe, they moved to some little perch on the northeastern seaboard, and there they were huddled in their new world, and you know, everything
right.
is cut off. But as you begin to immerse yourself in the records, you realize how aware they were, how aware they remained of goings on in Europe and in other parts of North America too. There was this, it was far from instantaneous, the communication, but they stayed very much in touch.
Yeah, and I was surprised how far down the social and economic scale that went. I mean, I guess it would make sense. You might expect that somebody like the governor of the colony, right? He would be writing letters back and forth across the ocean, or he might be traveling back and forth across the ocean. But I was really surprised to find that even quite poor people and women were making this journey back and forth to Europe multiple times. That really surprised me, I have to say, that they kept in touch even when they couldn't read or write. They relied on sailors who were going back and forth to tell them stories and news about their family and friends spread all across the world. And they knew what was going on, and they were in touch. And it might even be, you know, the original colonists' children who would go back to Amsterdam to collect a small inheritance. And that lets you know that they knew what was going on with their families on the small scale all the way across the ocean in this time period. And to me, that was really surprising.
Yeah. Unpacking a little bit further this the term intimate networks, this is a sentence from the book. The intimate networks people constructed, rather than actions taken by formal structures or metropolitan authorities, constituted empire. Is that maybe stretching it a little too far, that's what empire was, and it was not at all these other things that we think of, these, you know, formal structures?
Yeah. You know, I mean, there's a danger of going too far and saying that governments or companies don't matter. And I certainly don't want to go that far to say that those things don't matter. But it is amazing, and this is broadening out from New Netherland to think about early American empire generally. It is amazing how weak sometimes those companies and governments really were. There were a lot of for-profit companies founded to colonize in America. The Virginia Company of London is the famous one in Jamestown. The French had multiple companies too, as well as the West India Company for the Dutch. Every single one of these companies eventually is going to go out of business. But somehow that doesn't mean that colonization didn't happen or colonization failed. And similarly with the governments. you know, the governments could be very, very small and very, very weak in a lot of these colonies. And again, this is not just the Dutch, but early modern colonies in general. Their relationship with the home government could sometimes be pretty weak. And the amount of power that those authorities had to control people on the ground in these big, expansive colonies was sometimes very little, too. So it's funny because the companies and the governments are what generate the documents. So they're easiest to study and they're easiest to know about. But I don't think they're the most important element of making a colony work and creating transatlantic connections. To me, it seems more likely that all the small scale connections that individuals were making across the ocean really added up to something that was a lot weightier than just what the companies were doing or just what the colony governments were doing.
And why the weakness? Is it because we're talking about, compared to today, much smaller numbers of people, the distances mm-hmm. were greater? Why were those weaknesses there?
Yeah, sure. Certainly all those things. Also, sometimes, you know, people died a lot in these colonies. They weren't necessarily very healthy places to live, particularly in the early years. So, you know, if a colony government is small and then you have several deaths pretty quickly, then there's not much to it. Mm-hmm. So I think that can be why. And yeah, certainly I think a lot of it is compared to today, where we think of a government as a really organized bureaucracy with a lot of different people participating in it. All early modern governments were smaller, were weaker than that, not just colony governments. So yeah, some of it is in comparison to today, definitely.
And the specialness of this kind of framework for in relation to the Dutch colony Dutch empire. Elsewhere in the book, you say allegiances within colonial regimes often rested on emotions engendered through sexual and domestic relationships. I mean, surely that's the case of all societies everywhere.
Yeah, it probably is. You know, I think that the issue is that in colonies, these things could be brought into question a lot more. So if you were living in a small town in Europe and you stayed there throughout your entire life, you weren't necessarily putting your political identity to a whole lot of stress. But when you leave your home country and you move across the ocean to a new small colony and you're meeting a lot of different people who are from a lot of different backgrounds, then I think that there can be more that's brought into question. And so if you moved, let's say, to an English colony, let's say you were a Dutch person who moved to New England instead of New Netherland, by building a household, by marrying, say, an English immigrant woman, by establishing your family there, you're sort of creating a new loyalty often for yourself in that new colony.
So identities are shifting.
Yeah, I think they are. I think it's really a time when there's a tremendous amount of dynamic change. And even if it's remaking your old identity more strongly, you know, it's a time when things are in flux, definitely.
And because of that, individuals are often more able to it's kind of a Wild West. They're able to go and stake their claims, that kind of thing.
Well, that's a good question, actually, and that's definitely something I'm going to be considering in additional future research. Just how much were each one of these settler families and households independent actors? I think that's a really great question, and it's tough to know. On the one hand, if you were a colonist and you're going out to these areas, you really wanted the military protection of being nearby other colonists who agreed with you, who were allied with the same company you were allied with, or who spoke the same language as you, or from the same political background, or whatever. So there's also a force that sort of pulls people together because they are trying to take land and often trying to take land violently from Native Americans who outnumber them. On the other hand, these colonies had an annoying habit of setting up rules and laws that you might not really want to follow. So getting away and being more on your own, further away from other colonists, further away from a colony town, and being an independent actor, that might be appealing too. Mm-hmm. So I think these are really complex forces operating.
Yeah, because the
on
weakness
people.
That you talk about of the governments and these other structures would suggest that individuals had that much more freedom.
That's right. Yeah, that's exactly right. That maybe that they could impose their will to some extent, or they could operate on their own. You definitely sometimes, I think, in the records from New Netherland, get a sense of frustration on the part of the colony governor's part, particularly Stuyvesant in later years, where he really wants the colonists to live in particular places. He really wants them to behave in particular ways and build concentrated towns with walls around them and stay inside and follow the rules. And that's just not always happening.
Right.
And you can get a real sense of frustration in his letters about that.
Right. Okay, let's go to some examples of how the intimate networks paradigm works. So first, within the Dutch Republic itself, if everybody in your world is in the same province.
Right. How would these intimate networks work there,
you mean? Yeah.
Yeah. Well, you know, the Dutch were really on the forefront of pioneering some new systems of economic and business organization. So shareholders, they were breaking down companies, they were breaking down overseas investment into much, much smaller pieces than had been the practice in Europe before. And that was important if you were trying to do an overseas venture, if you were trying to get the money together to send goods out in a ship, right? That was a level of investment that really was beyond the means of most individuals, but you break it down into smaller shares and then all of a sudden it works. Well, the first of these kinds of companies in the Netherlands that broke down shares like this for the ownership and investment in ships actually were for the herring industry, were for fishing. And they often took place within a single town so that everybody who was in the town was an investor, a really small scale investment. People who were shoemakers, people who were bakers, people who were sailors and officers on the ship would be investors too. So that really a company was your intimate network often. It was the people that you met every day. These ownership of these companies were spread out in families. And as the Dutch began forming the larger monopoly companies to really do long distance trading, the East India Company and the West India Company, once again, you find that the ownership and the directorship of these companies really moved through families, often elite families in those cases, so that it was intimate networks who were pooling resources to invest together and often shared the directorship and the offices in these companies with other people who were within their families and within their intimate networks. So even in the Netherlands, there were these intimate networks that were structuring people's economic lives.
And going back in time, even further than that, the Netherlands being unique in Europe in that communities had to get together, band together to create these water boards to keep the sea out and to build dams and dikes and things like that. That was surely a strong cohesive force.
Yeah, it definitely was. And the structure of town organizations and neighborhood organizations within towns in the Netherlands was really strong and very striking. And that kind of thinking, that kind of organization is something that I think people took with them as they began living transcontinental lives too.
The Dutch East India Company came first. So does the intimate networks framework stretch that way, stretch eastward?
Yeah, I think it does. I think that the scholar Julia Adams has done a lot of work on that and has looked at the structure of the East India Company and the extent to which it overlaps with elite family networks. So definitely at the level of the directorship, the people who were running and investing in the company, and the people who were directing the company abroad from Batavia in what's today Jakarta as well. They were all bound by these sort of intimate networks too. My question would be how much that extends down to the level of the ordinary sailor and the ordinary soldier in the East Indies. It was a lot farther than going to America, and it was a lot deadlier, and fewer people came back. I think it's generally said something on the order of 2/3 of the people who left the Netherlands for the East Indies never returned. And that I think is different than the colony in North America, which was healthier and which was closer by. So I don't know how much intimate networks really continue to structure the lives of ordinary sailors and soldiers in the East India Company compared to the West India Company. I think that's something I'd love to see people do research on in the future.
Yeah, that's gets at a question that people sometimes ask me, and I don't have a good answer for. Why did New Netherland develop differently from other Dutch outposts? And one thing you're suggesting is, in the case of what's now Indonesia, the East Indies, life was it was farther away, and life was more dangerous, and there was less of a an occasion to develop a society with all these complicated networks among the people living there.
Yeah, definitely. Although, you know, it's interesting. Scholars like Jean Gelman Taylor have looked at life in Batavia, and family was a really, and household were really, really important in structuring daily life there too. And the town of Batavia in the East Indies sets up neighborhoods that are a lot like the different neighborhoods and towns that are really important in running things in the Netherlands. So mm-hmm. It definitely took different form, a lot more interracial marriage, a lot more ethnic diversity within the town, with a Chinese population and so on there within the town. So different than New Netherland, but nonetheless, I think maybe people are probably still turning to some of the same tools that they use in New Netherland.
So how does it work then, this the intimate network between the Dutch Republic and New Netherland? How does that sort of keep everybody bound together into one sort of larger network?
Right. Well, I guess we could think about it in terms of an individual. One of the women that I talk about a lot in my book is a woman named Janneke Jans van Leeuwarde. And she started out appearing in the records as the wife of a lower level officer, a soldier in Brazil. And she accompanied her husband to Brazil. And she participated in building their economic lives there together. They made loans to other soldiers. They made friends with other soldiers, many of whom died in Brazil. She later travels back from Brazil to the Netherlands in order to collect on those debts from the West India Company, to collect the deceased officers' wages to fulfill the loans that she and her husband made to them. She survived a shipwreck off the coast of England too, in order to do this. And later she and her husband move together to New Netherland after the Dutch have abandoned Brazil in the 1650s, and he sets up shop, becoming a shoemaker there. In New Amsterdam, yeah. And as a shoemaker, he needed to hire apprentices, people who knew something about shoemaking but would bind themselves to him to work with very little pay for a number of years. And it was his wife who went back to Amsterdam and who made the contracts with the young men to come out to New Netherland, to New Amsterdam, to work as apprentices. And she also carried on the couple's fur trading. She brought beaver skins that she and her husband had purchased in New Amsterdam back to Amsterdam for sale. And she negotiated who would serve as their representative there when they sent more furs over, a member of the Shoemakers Guild, so relying on their personal economic network to do that there in Amsterdam. So that kind of combination of travel and also relying on family relationships is really the way people created intimate networks that allowed them to have transatlantic economic lives.
And the need, they need, in this case, they presumably felt that they needed to go back to the old country to get apprentices. Surely there were some, you know, kids running around the streets of New Amsterdam they could have corralled, but they had their reasons having to do partly with their connections.
Yeah, I think so. I think that we don't know, you know, we don't have all of the documents of their lives, but I think that that's exactly right, that they knew people in the Shoemakers Guild in Amsterdam, and that's who they naturally thought of as people who would be appropriate to have working in their shop and living in their home, too. It's a very intimate relationship with your apprentices that you're setting up there.
And how these networks form then just within the colony itself, within New Netherland, because you've got different nationalities, people speaking different languages, and some different religions, although, you know, in the case of Stuyvesant, he didn't so much like that. But I mean, how do you sort of track the development of those kinds of networks?
Yeah, it can be hard. And it's always important to remember that most of people's social and intimate connections we're never going to know about. They didn't get written down on paper. So every network that I find, I imagine it as being much bigger than what I'm seeing, right? In terms of how you can reconstruct it, the church records are very important in New Amsterdam, where you can see baptism and people acting as witnesses and godparents for one another's children. That can give you a hint as to who is tied to who, who's close to who. And then later you often find those people cooperating together, those families cooperating together economically or politically as well. And in fact, it's interesting. If you look at some of the baptismal records in that survive from Dutch Brazil, you can find some of the families standing as witnesses for one another's children who later then migrate to New Netherland. And so clearly they form a network with one another that moves around the Atlantic to multiple places and yet stays tied together and helps one another out.
So there's the wider Dutch Atlantic network, and then there's within New Netherland, and that over time encourages a cohesiveness within among the residents of the colony, I presume.
Yeah, I think so. I think that's fair to say, although it probably also formed the basis for different factions and different opinions, as people's
because
intimate networks were not
in
all the same.
Yeah,
that's exactly right. That's exactly right. So, you know, I think it draws people together, but also networks can be the basis for exclusion. And to think about that, you know, you just have to think about the term that we have in today's society about something being an old boys network, right? I mean, that's a shorthand for saying it's unequal, it's unfair, it keeps people out, right? Well, that's a kind of network too. And so these intimate networks also kept people out, I think, as well as tied people in. And I think that's really important when you think about the African population in the colony. There was this enslaved population, many of whom were able to gain their freedom or at least limited forms of freedom in the colony. And there weren't a lot of racially exclusionary laws on the books. And that's true for the 17th century colonies in North America generally. A lot of the really racial laws that we think of establishing the basis for inequality and slavery and, you know, segregation. Most of those laws only developed over time and are really most prominent in the 1700s. Yet somehow, right, people of African descent were not treated equally. They didn't have an equal shot. They were the poorest people in the colony. They struggled. And I think that often it's their exclusion from these white intimate networks that makes those kind of racist laws unnecessary. Right? You didn't have to necessarily have a law saying, don't hire an African boy as a shoemaker's apprentice, right? You didn't have to have a law saying that wasn't allowed because people turned to their intimate networks to find those sort of employees, and Africans weren't in whites' intimate networks by and large. So yeah, it draws people together, but I think it's also the basis for a lot of exclusion and hierarchies too.
But the, and then you also look to some extent at trying to suss out the intimate networks among the Africans in the colony. So that develops something else develops there.
Yes, definitely. That I think is really crucial to explaining why this particular group of Africans in New Amsterdam ended up doing pretty well. They were people who arrived very early in the colony's history in the 1620s, and many of them managed to get their freedom and even become landowning farmers by the very end of the Dutch period. And that's a remarkable success for people of African descent in the 1600s in North American colonies. And I really think that one of the most important tools that they turn to is that they recreate family and kin networks that had been broken apart when people had been forcibly removed from Africa. So by marrying, by baptizing their children, and by having godparents for their children, they began to recreate networks of kin of people that they could rely on to help each other out and lift each other up, essentially.
So that gives them a strength, a cohesiveness within their community, and gives them a kind of, I guess, power.
Yeah, I think it does. You know, it's not necessarily power in terms of political power over others, but it is power in order to have autonomy. And that's the very first thing that you need, is to be able to determine some things for your own life and for your children. And they did succeed in doing that. Although it was obviously pretty fragile and pretty dangerous still to be a black person in colonial America.
And is there a difference between that community and how it formed these networks and they were empowered to some extent by them, and the other colonies, the English colonies?
Well, that's a good question. And to me, that's part of the importance in terms of the history profession, in terms of thinking generally about colonial America. That's some of the importance of studying New Netherland, is that it's a different base of documents. It's a different window into early colonial society than you get if you just look at the English colonies. So, for instance, in Virginia, you have Africans arriving at just about the same time in Virginia as they arrive in New Netherland, only separated by a few years. And actually, the very first Virginians of African descent arrive on a Dutch ship, a Dutch pirate ship. So these are people from very similar experiences and backgrounds. And unfortunately, because so many records from early Virginia have been destroyed, it's pretty difficult to know the fates of all of these really early arrivals. We do know that some Africans from the very earliest years in Virginia, most famously Anthony Johnson and his wife Mary Johnson in Virginia, did achieve freedom and did become landowners. But we don't really know much about how or why they succeeded in doing so. But if you look at New Netherland, I think that gives you a window into the kind of tools that these early African arrivals used to try and negotiate lives in slavery.
So you're saying the records are better for New Netherland with regard to Africans?
Yes, I think they are. You really don't have the kind of baptism and marriage records and church records for the English colonies in these very early years as regards Africans that you do in New Netherland. So it's much more difficult to identify and trace out families and intimate networks in English colonies. Whether or not that means they weren't there, it's really hard to know. But that's certainly what Africans tried to do in New Netherland.
So if Africans in New Netherland have managed to recreate these networks, and that empowers them within the colony, the same is not true of the relations between New Netherlanders and the Native Americans.
Right. Those are much harder to trace out. And it's very difficult to know about the kind of intimate and family relationships that New Netherlanders set up with Native Americans. But I will say that you're absolutely right that the intimate networks seemed to consistently divide Native Americans and whites in the colony. Some later colonies in other empires like Canada, like New France, you see a lot of intermarriage between French fur traders and Native American women. And we don't have evidence of anywhere near as much of that going on in New Netherland. Mm-hmm. And I think that represents a boundary, that represents a wall between these two communities. There was a lot of trade. There was a lot of contact. People lived nearby one another. Those Native American towns, Munsee towns, were really close to a lot of Dutch towns in the Hudson Valley. But people weren't forming intimate networks that spanned those two communities to any really great extent.
Talk about the Native woman, Quashawan. And she's someone who formed kind of a bond within the colony.
Well, she's a really interesting case. She lived on the very eastern tip of Long Island, and she was a Montauk. And she became, in the 1660s, a very powerful woman. She was from a powerful family. Her father, Wyandonch, had been a major sachem, a major leader there. And so she comes to power because of her intimate networks within the Montauk and the Native American community on Long Island. She does seem to be someone who is interested in forming alliances with the Dutch. I interpret some documents from 1664 is referring to her from New Netherland. The documents mention a Vildin. That's the Dutch word for savage woman, Indian woman. But they don't give her name. And I think that represents Quashawam reaching out to try and form an alliance with the Dutch to try and put the brakes on some English land expansion on Long Island. But the Dutch do not seem to be interested in dealing with her. And so in 1664, she makes a very strong alliance with John Scott, an Englishman instead. And within a few months, New Netherland is taken over by English forces. And John Scott was active in military maneuvers on Long Island to secure it for the English.
So you're suggesting what exactly?
I'm suggesting that there's something really interesting going on here, and that the
she
Dutch
played a
were,
role in the English takeover.
Yeah, I think she did. I don't know how important her role is, but certainly she would have been a force who could have been allied on the Dutch side. But the Dutch consistently seem to be uninterested in working with female Native American political leaders. And I think that's something that is consistent throughout the Dutch period. Mm.
One or two of the other women who you focus on in the life of the colony, the African Isabel Quesana from Angola.
Yeah, she's just fascinating. She's one of these African women who live in New Amsterdam, who forms an intimate network, is active in baptism, standing as witness for other people's children and so on, and becomes part of the community that achieves at least kind of limited forms of freedom, often known as half freedom, during the Dutch period. So she's an example of somebody who's able to use the creation of an intimate network very successfully to build an independent life for herself in the colony.
How do you see this book as either responding to or fitting into the literature on New Netherland?
I really want my book to build on the excellent work that's been done in recent years. I think Jaap Jacobs really provided for us the first complete, using Dutch sources, complete overview of the colony's growth and development. And I think a lot of us now can begin going in new and more focused directions, because we can rely on Yop's book being there, and that people will be able to turn to Yop's book to find out the overview of what's going on in the colony. So I really see the literature on New Netherland as really developing a lot, and we're really knowing more and more all the time about the social development of the colony. Jani Venema's work is wonderful as well in that regard, and really telling us about the development of particular towns like Beverwijk, and letting us know how the colony developed socially. It's not, you know, in terms of other fields of colonial history, it's not a gigantic field here, right, working right. on the Dutch. So in some ways, what I'd like to do is to try and engage people who also work on New England, or people who work on Virginia, and helping point out to them that there's a really important and there's a really interesting colony up there that can maybe shed some light on the way early modern empires were working in North America.
Let's switch gears and talk about this newer work. You mentioned the Dutch word wilden, and which translates as wild people or savages, and they're the way that they refer to the Native Americans. And I think when you're, you know, someone's reading the records in translation or otherwise, you just kind of say, okay, that's the term they used. But you kind of tease out new meanings by comparing that with the way that they use the same word elsewhere.
Right. Yeah. It's a tough word, and translation is always a really difficult game, because we like to think that there's a one-to-one correlation, right? What's the word for this, right? But it doesn't work that way, especially because the meaning of words, even within a language, changes over time. So the word that's most often used for Native Americans or Indians in New Netherland is wilden. And that's a word that was also used for indigenous people in other parts of the world too. So in that sense, it doesn't quite work the way that Indians works. Although it's tempting to translate wilden as Indians. In fact, the Dutch talk about people in Papua New Guinea as wilden, people in Australia as wilden, people on Polynesian islands are sometimes referred to as wilden. And in the early years, South Africans are also referred to as wilden. But it's interesting because sometimes the Dutch won't use that word. Sometimes the Dutch will use the word Indianen, which really is a cognate of the English word Indians. And it's very interesting to see where and why and when they will choose to use one word or the other. So, for instance, there were quite a few Dutch adventurers, privateers would be the polite word, I guess, who were trying to initiate in the early 1600s Dutch attacks on the Spanish Empire in Peru and Chile. And there, the Dutch refer to indigenous Americans most often as Indianen and not as wilden, as they call them in North America. So that's something that you've got to kind of pay attention to. That's also the word Indianen is what they use for people in India as well. So there might be a different meaning to these two words, and it might be very important to consider why it is that the Dutch would refer to the people in North America and in the Hudson Valley as wilden.
Adrian Vanderdonk a couple of times refers to them as Americans.
Yeah. You also see these other words appearing, Americans. Sometimes when they're mad, they'll talk about them as heidenen, heathen, or barbaren, you know, barbarians too. So it's interesting to me, particularly in New Netherland, because the Dutch colonists were quite aware of the different national and tribal affiliations that Native Americans had. They knew the difference between Mohawks and Mohegans and Hackensacks and Montauks. They had to know the difference between these different groups of people because they had different alliances, they had different trade patterns, they had different wars with all these different groups. Yet most often the documents, they refer to them by this collective word Vilden. And that suggests that even though they had alliances, for instance, with the Mohawk, they still saw them somehow as the same, as equivalent to people they identified as savages all across the world.
As if I read it right, you seem to be suggesting that the use of the term by the Dutch relates to the Dutch as this kind of a people that puts this economic trade template onto things. And if there are people who are outside of that framework, then, you know, in other words, Vilden doesn't just mean they live in the woods. It means we can't trade with them, or we can't find a way to trade with them. But of course, they did trade with the Indians of North America.
Yeah. And that's very interesting, I think. If you look at the earliest years, really before the colony of New Netherland gets going, and you look at travel narratives, I do think there's a pattern that in places where trade is not working, they'll say, these people are Vilden, right? They're useless to the company. One author writes about New Guinea. They don't want anything, right? Mm-hmm. That was a complaint about people in South Africa, that they didn't want to buy stuff from the Dutch because they didn't need it. And so, well, they're Vilden. They don't understand the way that we work. They don't understand money. They're not acquisitive enough. And that's the word then that gets applied to North America, to New Netherland, even though a thriving trade does develop there. So it's interesting and intriguing, I guess I'd say, and perhaps should make us think about the fact that eventually the Dutch are, and Dutch descendants in the Hudson Valley, are going to be very focused on taking land and setting up a settler colony there. They're not just a trading post. They're not just a trading outpost. And perhaps the fact that they see these people as Vilden somehow justifies that to
them. So that word has implicit in it the idea that these are ultimately adversaries.
I don't know if it's necessarily ultimately adversaries, but I think it does suggest an idea of inferiority. Mm-hmm. And that sense of, hey, those people are inferior, would justify the taking of land. Mm-hmm. So sometimes, you know, in these traveler narratives, for instance, to the islands of Polynesia, they almost romanticized the people there. They were wonderful. They were so friendly. We danced with them in the moonlight. They gave us all this fruit, but they're Vilden. Mm-hmm. They didn't know anything about money. They don't have any trade routes. Well, they did, but the Dutch couldn't see or understand them. So that, you know, it's not necessarily always a sign of total hostility to refer to somebody as Vilden, but I think it does suggest that the Dutch did see themselves as superior.
Last couple of questions. Let me ask you about your perspective on the field of New Netherland studies. You touched on it a minute ago. You said it's small, and of course it is. Do you see it expanding or growing in any particular directions? How do you see it interacting with the other colonial arenas?
Yeah, I definitely think it's expanding a lot. And the translations that have been done by Charlie Gehring and Jannie Venema at the New Netherland Institute are an important part of that, because it certainly lets scholars who are really focused on English colonies nonetheless draw in some documents from New Netherland and work comparatively. The number of people, too, who in the United States who are learning Dutch and using the Dutch documents does seem to be increasing. Back when I first started, there really were not very many of us at all. But I feel like I meet quite a number of graduate students now who are doing this. And also, I have to say, in the Netherlands, for a long time, the Atlantic was underemphasized and somewhat ignored, because it seemed like the really rich documents and the really exciting things going on from the perspective of people in the Netherlands were all going on in the East Indies. They were all going on in today's Indonesia. So for a long time, there were very few Dutch scholars at all working on the Atlantic, let alone New Netherland. Those Dutch scholars who were working on the Atlantic tended to focus solely on Brazil. And that's definitely changing. Mm-hmm. There's a lot more attention being paid to the Atlantic by Dutch scholars. And it still continues to focus on the Caribbean more than North America, but I think increasingly we'll see more and more Dutch scholars interested in it too.
And what are you working on now?
Well, now I'm trying to stick with the Hudson Valley colony, but to take it a little bit more global. So right now I'm trying to look at issues of household formation and the way that people staked claims to space in different colonies around the world. So I'm very interested in those homes and farms that people are building throughout the Hudson Valley. And I'm also interested, though, in the neighborhoods that people are constructing in places like Batavia, in what is today Jakarta. So as the Dutch are moving around the world, people have to say, hey, this is my land, right? People have to signal to each other, to indigenous residents, to also forced or enslaved populations they're bringing, whose land is whose. And that's true for native people and indigenous people too, right? They need to signal, you know, this isn't an area that it's okay for you to have as a pasture. This is my farmland. This is our land. And same with enslaved people. They have to be able to stake a claim and say, hey, this is our garden space. Even though enslaved people are not allowed to own property legally, in general, nonetheless, enslaved people in every colony do set up households and do set up space that is customarily recognized as theirs. So I'm curious about how people do that and how people use households and family relationships as they try and signal to one another whose land is whose.
So in other words, it's about space as a, I don't know, process of identifying what they would consider civilization within the Dutch world of the 17th
yeah,
century?
Yeah, definitely for the Dutch, that's true. How that they set up a space that they can call their own and that they can define as part of their towns and cities and under their government. Yeah, mm-hmm. Definitely.
Wonderful. Well, good luck with it.
Thank you.
Okay, Dr. Susanna Romney, thanks for chatting.
Oh, and thanks so much for talking to me.